It's been called brutal questioning, enhanced interrogation, harsh practices. Last week, when the Senate Intelligence Committee released its report on the CIA's interrogation techniques, it became widely known as the torture report. But long after hearing about those techniques, not everyone is calling it that. Now, most news organizations have standards editors. Ours here at NPR has instructed us that we can use the word torture to describe the techniques used by the CIA. But the report has reignited a long-standing debate over just what word to use. And NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik is here with more. And David, start off with the definition of torture. It has several.
Well, so I'm looking at a version that was absorbed into U.S. law a couple of decades ago, and it's parallel with language incorporated from international laws and treaties. And torture means an act, and this I'm quoting here, committed by a person acting under the color of law, specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering. It can also be about threats of imminent death, that somebody's going to kill you or that somebody's going to kill somebody important or close to you. Severe physical pain or suffering comes in there, but so does, you know, harm or prolonged mental harm, as well. And all these things combine in a way that makes sense under law, but also that we think about if we talk about it with one another. There's a common sense everyday version of it, and there's an ethical, moral, or religious definition as well. These are sort of very closely but slightly different overlapping meanings for what we think of when we talk about torture.
Yeah, but I've heard some people try to thread that needle, those who support the techniques. You said that the definition involves wanting to inflict pain or suffering, which sounds punitive. And people who have defended the techniques have said this wasn't about punishing people. This was trying to get to information. Therefore, it wasn't about trying to inflict pain for pain itself. It was not torture. I mean, we've heard this. So there have been people.
Sure, that's That's absolutely an argument. You know, as you look back about coverage, let's talk about waterboarding. By no means the only way in which such interrogations were done that constitute what we think of as torture when done by other folks. You know, that was a practice that was used by, you know, the Inquisition, by folks on behalf of the Roman Catholic Church and call it the 14th century, trying to extract information. The idea was not to do permanent damage, not to kill anyone. It was – there were medical practitioners of that age present. But, you know, it was to extract information. But by any realistic person looking at it, and certainly by the time of the Age of Enlightenment, this was something that revulsed Western society at that time, which said, you know, we can't do that anymore. Americans, you know, if you look at a couple of articles in the Washington Post and elsewhere, imported the practice actually from the Philippines, which had been a Spanish colony, but of course that the U.S. Started takeover at the turn of the previous century. So you're seeing something that really has roots in centuries-old practices. You may call it interrogation and non-punitive, but the effect it has on people seems to very neatly fit what we think of as definitions of torture.
Well, and you alluded to something. It's okay if I do it, or someone else does. It's not okay if we do it or the reverse. In 2010, the Harvard University Kennedy School of Government found that American news organizations tended to refer to waterboarding as torture if other countries did it, but they weren't as likely to do that when it was the U.S. Just David, you are a media critic. What's the responsibility of a news organization, the New York Times or NPR, Washington Post, to use words that clarify?
I think it's incumbent on news organizations to use words that clarify, but I think also with the caveat of you know, it's important to offer care, right? So when the closer something is to home, the more careful we're going to be. The major fault in the Rolling Stone article that we've talked about in recent days and weeks in which, you know, there's the tale of the woman who said she had been raped was that there was not the presumption of innocence. So let's say that we need to grant that presumption of innocence. After all, if torture has a legal definition and is prosecutable, which it is among in both American law and in American military codes, then we need to make sure not to seemingly convict somebody before they've been tried. That said, the acts that we're talking about seem very much to fit in this. I actually first wrote about this, I think, in 2004 for the Baltimore Sun as some of the first revelations of actions taken, I believe, by U.S. Armed forces in Iraq and in Afghanistan started to trickle out. You know, you referred to that study, and they looked at coverage from the 1930s until the story started breaking in 2004 when I started really taking a look at it. And the New York Times characterized waterboarding as torture in 81% of the articles they found. And the Los Angeles Times did so in 96%. That is, they called it almost uniformly torture. After that point, the New York Times called waterboarding, as of the time studied by the folks at Harvard, in 1.4% of articles, two of 143 articles. Similarly, the Los Angeles Times did so in just under 5%. That is a radical shift in what we're willing to call. And, you know, I think that by hedging, by allowing terms, euphemisms to slip in, you know, one of the preferred ones from folks at the CIA is enhanced interrogation techniques. You know, that to me is a term without meaning. It sounds like you're using an enhanced digital camera. At one point, you heard the CIA director John Brennan recently refer to EITs in recent days as though that as an acronym for, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques. That sounds like either a real estate investment or some statistic for fantasy league football. It's an incredibly intentional way to distance people from thinking about, you know, the brutality of what was done in our name.
Well, that's, I guess, what I was getting at, that maybe if we just didn't call it anything, didn't, you know, not torture, not IETs, but just say what it is, describe the act. But of course, we didn't, as reporters, know what all of the acts were. You say there's another angle to this story about how the CIA approached leaked information. Just your thoughts on that.
Well, so one of the things you learned in the report, and it wasn't scandalous, but it was certainly something that raised eyes inside the profession, was the ways in which the CIA very much cultivated certain reporters that it would selectively leak classified information to. Not declassify the information, but actually leak classified information to them. Ron Kessler, an author who's been somewhat sympathetic, Doug Gell now at the Washington Post, but previously at the New York Times, who seemed to assure them that he would portray certain incidents in a positive light, yielding useful information. Tom Brokaw, the former anchor for NBC News, was seen as a friendly figure, and that they would leak this to them. And no complaints were filed because, of course, the agency itself was involved in the leak of that classified information. However, it on a number of occasions, as the Senate report noted, filed these formal letters of complaint on other moments where reporters obtained classified information, not perhaps through, you know, the PR channels at the CIA or through the top officials there, but through unsanctioned channels. And they formally complained for that. Well, both the instances would seemingly violate, you know, the classified nature of the information and therefore possibly involve an illegal leak. But you know, they only selectively wanted to go after those people. It was a sign of which things are, you know, perhaps overclassified, but also ways in which the CIA plays things to its advantage rather than simply on a national security basis.
NPR's media correspondent David Fogenflik. David, thanks for shedding some light on this.
You bet.